Production. Recorded live.
Hello, everyone. This is Carl Schuneman, Director of Legal Analytics and Review at Jurnov, and welcome to another edition of ESI Bytes, where we offer information from national speakers on electronic discovery at a price everyone can afford, which is free, and available whenever they're interested in listening to it, which is whenever you download it or put it on an iPod or iPad or whatever device you want to listen to the show on. Today we have a real interesting and topical show, which came about when a listener of ESI Bytes sent me an article in the ABA Journal last month, which described a comprehensive survey on sanctions and e-discovery cases, which was compiled by the law firm of King & Spalding called Sanctions for E-Discovery Violations by the Numbers. I contacted the survey's author, Dan Willoughby, or one of the authors, and he agreed to do a podcast, and I then decided to have two judges on the program who might come at the issue differently based on their jurisdictions. As the Honorable James Francis is from one of the largest jurisdictions in the U.S., the Southern District of New York, and as an ex-New Yorker, I feel comfortable saying that sometimes how things are done in New York might not be how things are done in more collegial settings. So I decided to invite the Honorable Richard Sankovitz from Wisconsin to participate in the program, although since the Steelers lost to the Packers, I might have rethought about that if I did the show today, living in Pittsburgh. But you know, you got to do what you can do here. So I decided to invite the Honorable Richard Sankovitz from Wisconsin to participate in the program. And since sanctions can be such a divisive topic on which judges in their own jurisdictions don't even completely agree, let alone across jurisdictions. And then while drafting the questions, I thought it'd be real interesting to add a plaintiff voice to the discussion. With all these different perspectives, and that's Jim Batson, I have no idea how the show will evolve, but it should be interesting. So to introduce the panelists a little bit more formally, the Honorable James C. Francis IV has been a United States magistrate judge in the Southern District of New York since October of 1985. He received his BA from Yale College in 1974, his Juris Doctorate degree from Yale Law School in 1978, and a master's degree in public policy from the John F. Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University, also in 1978. He's clerked for the Honorable Robert L. Carter in the Southern District of New York. He then joined the Civil Appeals and Law Reform Unit of the Legal Aid Society, where he conducted impact litigation in the areas of housing and education, and served as the director of the Disability Rights Unit. Judge Francis currently serves as an adjunct professor at the Fordham University School of Law, where he teaches constitutional torts. In the field of electronic data and the law, Judge Francis is the author of Roe Entertainment v. William Morris Agency, which was a case involving procedures for electronic discovery and the allocation of costs, Convolve, Inc. v. Compaq Computer Corp., which concerned the obligation to preserve ephemeral data, Treple v. BioVail Corp., which deals with standards for preservation orders for electronic data, Roselle v. Ross Holst, which discusses the relevance of emails to a claim of computer hacking. There was a second opinion in Treple, which dealt with remedies for the spoliation of electronically stored information, and Richard Green Fine Paintings versus McClendon, which permitted additional discovery and shifted costs as a consequence of the destruction of electronically stored information. Thanks for joining us on the show. Judge Sankovitz presides in Branch 29 of the Milwaukee County Circuit Court. He was appointed in 1996 and was reelected in 1997, 2003, and 2009. He currently serves in the Felony Division. Previously, he served in the Civil Division. He's presided over each of the court's specialty calendars, domestic violence, drugs, guns, and homicide, sexual assault. He graduated from Harvard Law School in 1983 and from Marquette University with a BA summa cum laude in 1980. He's a member of the Ad Hoc Subcommittee of the Judicial Council that drafted the 2011 amendments to Wisconsin's Rules of Civil Procedure governing electronic discovery, and is currently studying a Wisconsin analog to Rule 502 of the Federal Rules of Evidence. His presentation to fellow judges is entitled Electronic Discovery, New Wine in Old Bottles. In private practice, he was a shareholder with White Hirschbach Dudek in Milwaukee and an associate at Jenner Block. And prior to that, he was in private practice as a law clerk with the Honorable Terrence Evans. In addition, I'll mention Judge Sankovitz was highly recommended to be on a podcast with me by Kelly Twigger from ESI Attorneys. And we've been waiting to do a show for well over a year, and I thought this would be a good one. So glad to have you on the show.
It took a year for the Packers to get into the Super Bowl, so now it's appropriate.
Well, good thing I'm I don't know if Judge Francis is a Jets fan, but we're not going to base when people come on based on when they're in the Super Bowl. I'm a Jets fan too, so
we won't go there, Carl.
Okay. The other panelist, Dan Willoughby, is a partner at King and Spalding and an author of the recent survey on sanctions I mentioned. Dan is a member of King and Spalding's eDiscovery group. He heads up the firm's eDiscovery Discovery Center, which is an offsite facility located near the firm's offices in Midtown Atlanta that houses 175 staff and project attorneys, paralegals, project assistants, and technical staff. Dan's devoted his career to the management of major discovery matters, began his discovery work in 1986 assisting Brown and Williamson Tobacco Corporation in collecting and coding millions of pages of documents in preparation for discovery demands in the second wave of tobacco litigation in the late 1980s. Over the ensuing 20 years, Dan has been at the leading edge of developments in discovery technology, adapting the firm's processes and client offerings as each new technology emerges. He frequently lectures in the field of e-discovery, including instructing on the steps involved in the e-discovery process, best practices derived from the years of experience and pitfalls to be avoided. His unique career and 20-plus years of work on major discovery matters has made him one of the more knowledgeable lawyers in the country on the challenges of e-discovery and the vendor resources available to assist in meeting client needs. So glad to have you on the show, Dan. And Jim's a personal favorite since, in addition to being a partner at Little and Batson,
Little and Robinson.
Little and Robinson, sorry.
Maybe someday.
Jim's been a leader in the field of electronic discovery from the claimant's perspective. He was counsel of record for the plaintiff on all of the widely followed Zubelake v. UBS Warburg decisions, on which the jury returned a verdict in favor of Laura Zubelake in the amount of $29.2 million. This is the grandfather of e-discovery spoliation cases, so we're thrilled to have Jim join us on another ESI Byte show. That's the introduction. Now I'm tired from talking, so let's start the show. Dan, why don't you start off by telling us about your recent survey, and is the problem of sanctions growing?
Sure. And I just want to add that I'm a lifelong Atlanta Falcon fan, and we also got left in the wake of the Packers on the way to the Lombardi Trophy. But along with two other colleagues here at King & Spalding in Atlanta, Rose Jones and Greg Antine, we conducted a survey of all cases involving motions for sanctions arising out of discovery relating to the discovery of electronically stored information in federal courts prior to January 1, 2010, relying on written opinions. So what we tried to do is we tried to get all the written opinions prior to January 1, 2010, in federal court where a motion for sanction was filed that related to ESI. There may be some paper involvement there as well, but there had to be ESI, and the sanctions motion had to at least in part relate to that ESI. And once we did that comprehensive survey, we had identified 401 cases prior to January 1, 2010, and we found 230 sanction awards. And what we did is we then analyzed them for a variety of factors, including the sanctioning court, the authority for the sanction, who was the sanction party, type of sanction, and what was the misconduct that underlied the sanction motion and potentially the sanction award. Our analysis indicated that the number of e-discovery sanction cases was generally increasing and that there was a significant increase in both motions and awards since 2004. We couldn't find any correlation as to particular types of cases or types of courts. What we found is that there were motions for sanctions and awards for sanctions in all courts across the country, in 75 federal district courts across the country, and all of the numbered court of appeals. We found that they were in all types of cases: employment cases, contract cases, IP cases, tort cases. With, you know, employment cases 17%, contracts 16%, IP cases 15%. So they were in all different types of cases, permeating courts and case type. We found that the sanctions imposed against parties in some cases were very severe. There were dismissals and default judgments, adverse jury instructions, and significant monetary awards. We found that sanctions against counsel, while truly uncommon, that they were on the rise. And what we also found was that once you started to get into the kind of 2003-2004 time frame, you saw a real uptick in the number of sanction awards. And we found that there were more sanction awards in 2009, the last year of the survey, than in any other prior year. And in fact, what we found was that there were more e-discovery sanction cases in 2009 than in all years prior to 2005 combined.
Wow, so we've got a real clear trend looking upward. I'd like to get some of the judges' reaction, first Judge Francis and then Judge Sankovitz. What's your reaction to these trends, and are you seeing or hearing of an increase or decrease in the types of behavior which can lead to sanctions in an e-discovery matter?
Well, I think from the judicial perspective, any one judge has a sample size that's really too small to be the basis for comment, which I think is one of the virtues of Dan's study. It gives us a much broader base for drawing conclusions. So while I might see an increase or a decrease in the number of sanctions motions, I'm not sure that that's representative. I think Dan's study does a much better job of identifying the trend. And with respect to the trend, I'm not so sure that it's a bad thing. That is, that there are increasing numbers of sanctions motions. I think if what you have out there is bad behavior, then the fact that it is being sanctioned may well be a good thing, and that may help to modify the behavior of counsel, the behavior of parties in connection with e-discovery problems. So I accept that the trend is upward. Hopefully it won't be upward forever, but I think that there are reasons for that have to do with the volume of electronic data out there, the difficulties that parties have dealing with it, and frankly the fact that have not taken it as seriously as they need to. Now, having said that, I don't have a representative sample of cases, I will say that anecdotally, I think that the major firms, the more sophisticated firms, are beginning to get it. They are dealing much better now with e-discovery than they did in the past. Smaller firms, individual parties, are still more likely to be behind the curve and not up to speed yet. But I think that the trend that Dan has identified is definitely borne out in our court.
Okay, and Judge Sankovitz, your take on this?
Well, I'd agree with what Judge Francis said, and I'd say kind of like this, where I stand, I'm kind of like a coast watcher down in Australia who's heard reports of an earthquake off of India or somewhere in the South Pacific and is just waiting for the tsunami to roll in. That wave hasn't reached our shores yet. We've barely begun to see the wave rise in the ocean around us, certainly in state courts, but even in federal courts around here. And I think that the reason for that and the reason for the curve, so to speak, the curve that Judge Francis referred to, is the reluctance of the profession to change. Electronic discovery is there. Electronic information is there. It's an opportunity for parties. It's where the truth lies. And I think the reason that parties haven't come to grips with it is that they are reluctant to change, both clients and attorneys alike. And if you could map out the sanctions themselves, I think that's a measure of the depth of denial that lawyers are in about changing. They don't send their lawyers send their clients letters asking them to preserve information. They don't respond to requests, and they don't look far enough for ESI. And then when they get confronted with it, they resort to what scoundrels often resort to, which is dissembling and fabricating and then we end up with sanctions. We haven't seen that here yet, but we have seen trends like this in other fields that have developed over the course of time, and so we know it's only a matter of time before we'll have to use sanctions to get people to change. The good thing about what Dan has done and his partners have done is to publicize this, so the lawyers who are smart about looking forward rather than keeping their head in the sand are going to see that this is something they'll really need to change in order to avoid in the future. So I see out here, you know, off the shores of the epicenters of electronic discovery litigation on the coasts and in larger cities, I see that change coming, and I think there'll be sanctions, and we'll have our era where there's a lot of sanctions, and then people will get it, and then the sanctions will drift off, and then we'll move on to the next area where people have to change.
Okay. Jim, you've got a different position from being on the plaintiff side. Do you think the motions for sanctions might be overused, or is it the conduct of electronic discovery cases that are so messy at times that you just need to vent and ask the judge to punish the other side?
Well, it's hard to answer a question about overused generally. I'm sure there are instances where applications for sanctions are made that are premature or unwarranted. But generally, I think they're not being overused because the opportunity for misconduct or gross negligence when dealing with ESI is so much greater, in my opinion, than it was or still is with respect to hard copy documents. You know, electronic evidence is so easy to alter or delete. A click of a button can do a ton of harm, and I just think the temptation can be so great to parties at times, especially when you're dealing with a party that consists of, you know, thousands in some instances of individuals, you know, in a corporation. It's not hard for one or two people to think that the smart thing to do is delete something and that they'll never be, it'll never come back to them, and based in large part on ignorance of how ESI works. Wherever there's an opportunity for misconduct and bad faith and negligence, we're going to see conduct that merits sanctions. And I would echo what Judge Francis said earlier, which is, you know, these motions as well as the decisions themselves help publicize the ramifications of that kind of action and spread the word so that people are less likely to engage in that kind of conduct.
I agree with Jim that in general sanctions are not overused. I think they're overused in two instances. One is that there are a few cases where counsel see an opportunity for a gotcha moment, and they believe that they can prevail in litigation not on the merits but on the basis of a sanctions application. So I see a little bit of that. I also think that counsel tend to bring these motions before judges whom they perceive of as being keen on e-discovery issues. So I think there are a few judges who tend to be burdened with these more than some other judges.
And I'd add to that, as Judge Sankovitz, add to that, these motions are also brought in front of judges who have a reputation for being willing to sanction.
Yep.
You know, electronic discovery, like all discovery, is an area where most judges are of a mind to say a pox on both your houses and not really deal with the case at all, and that's frustrating for lawyers. But what's almost equally frustrating is when you're a lawyer in front of a judge who's a little bit too willing to grant a sanction, because then the case becomes all about the sanction litigation and not about the merits of the case itself.
Yeah, you actually gave me an idea for podcasts. I haven't yet delved into markets which are where lawsuits are oftentimes brought, and you know, and there's people talk about forum shopping. I think that'd be an interesting discussion.
You have to understand too, with sanctions, you know, sanctions are not uniform. There's a whole panoply of potential sanctions, and I think when people hear the word sanctions, they think of the more severe ones, the adverse inference instruction, or worse, you know, claim dispositive sanction. But there are lots of far lesser sanctions that I think are meted out regularly and probably not as often in published decisions, but where something is lost, it should have been preserved, you know, parties awarded additional depositions or the cost of taking the first deposition because it was produced late. Things like that are sanctions to be sure in terms of the definition, but not the, you know, not the horrible sanction that people fear in conducting discovery.
That's a great answer. That's
absolutely borne out by the survey.
If you look at the survey and you read the cases, you see a range of conduct that doesn't meet up to the e-discovery standards, and you see a range of sanctions coming back at them in response to that conduct, and in some cases denying the motion for sanctions outright. But what we found is, while there are for the most egregious e-discovery sanctions, the terminating sanctions of dismissal or default judgment, and also the very serious, often case killer sanction of adverse jury instructions and monetary awards, we also found judges that were trying to be creative or flexible or reactive to the particular fact pattern. And we found, evidence preclusion, witness preclusion, striking of a particular defense tied to a particular piece of evidence. We saw a reduced burden of proof, possibly in a case like a fraud case, clear and convincing down to preponderance. We saw removal of jury charges, limiting of closing statements, supplemental discovery, just given a couple of more definitions to see if there's some alternative source of information for the lost data. And then we've seen, giving the requesting party direct access to the data source, primarily when the judge has kind of lost trust in the producing party and wants to allow that requesting party to get right in there to see what's going on. But with the big cases, we did find over time that there was a fair degree for e-discovery of these big sanctions. We found 36 cases where there were terminating sanctions of dismissals or defaults. We found 52 cases with adverse jury instructions, often different kinds, but 52 adverse jury instruction awards of all flavors. And then we found 77 monetary sanctions, 5 above $5 million, 4 above $1 million, and in total we found 27 awards over $100,000.
Wow, and to round out that data, Dan, who do you see being sanctioned the most, the defense or the plaintiffs?
I was kind of interested in that, and I had my ideas going in, and my ideas going in did not bear out in the trends. What we found was that defendants are more often than plaintiffs to be sanctioned 3-1. I had thought that would be the case, likely because of the asymmetrical discovery obligations. Defendants typically have more data, and often you have a David and Goliath situation where someone has a lot of data on one side and not on the other side. That did not change greatly over time. It stuck pretty much to 3-1. I predict over time that there will be more sanctions of plaintiff, and we'll all recognize that Judge Shindlin's 2010 Pension Committee case was a case in which the plaintiffs, 13 different groups of plaintiffs, were sanctioned for their failure to retain ESI.
Jim, even though the plaintiffs are not sanctioned as often, their numbers are growing too. Are you concerned about this risk as a plaintiff? Not only do you have to learn how to ask for the information more intelligently, but you also have to now watch your own clients. Is it getting harder?
Absolutely. I'm concerned, and all plaintiffs' attorneys better be. Picking up on what I said a minute ago about corporations having to essentially police great numbers of people, there's a flip side to that. When you represent an individual who's less sophisticated in many instances than a corporation is about the technical aspects of preservation and when there's a litigation and the ability to retrieve information, what have you, I think the temptation for a plaintiff who's perhaps viewing their future to be dependent on the case, the temptation can be very great to alter their e-discovery, to delete documents that they think would be hurtful or trying to recreate documents, or that they're just not as aware of how careful they need to be, and so they delete things inadvertently. It's one thing when you have a personal computer that's 5 years old, it may be more likely to crash than you know, the corporate system that has backups and parallel systems and what have you. So I think it's critical for a plaintiff's attorney to advise their client in the very first meeting of their obligation to preserve things and to put that advice in writing in some form to remind them that if litigation is conceivable, that they should preserve everything conceivably related to that litigation. And then go a step further to actually have a mirror image made of any hard drive or hard drives that they have that might contain relevant ESI, because, you know, people use their personal computers so frequently that it's very easy to overwrite stuff after the fact.
Mr. Sankovitz, I'd add on to that for individuals who are wrapped up in litigation, I think where the real risk of sanction-worthy conduct is going to be with social media, because people, no matter how sophisticated they are or not, tend to blab whatever they can on their Facebook page or whatever, and then when they're concerned about whether somebody will find out what they've said, they try to take steps to delete it. Of course, those are futile steps, but the very act of trying to cover their tracks becomes evidentiary. So I'd agree with the advice that when you pick up any kind of lawsuit, that you have that kind of inventory of your client's electronic data and then some very explicit warnings about what can happen if people try to monkey with it. When I was practicing, I much preferred dealing with an organization that was sued repeatedly because they had some discipline about how to maintain the evidence. When you're dealing with somebody that was a brand new organization, a brand new partnership, brand new joint venture, something like that, or individuals, you had to spend a lot more time trying to create that discipline yourself with your client at the outset.
Yes, in fact, picking up on that, the point of social media sites is a related issue. Is people have so many different sources of relevant evidence now, just as an individual. There's the social media sites that were just discussed, then the home computers I mentioned a minute ago, and then how many people have email accounts that are in the cloud, as they say, not at their home computer, but the Yahoo and the Hotmail, et cetera, those kinds of accounts. People tend to have lots of relevant emails in there, and they're unfamiliar, because they haven't had occasion to deal with it, with what those sites' protocols and procedures are for deleting old emails. So somebody may think they have 100 relevant emails saved up on their Yahoo account and aren't aware that if you don't touch an email or you don't open the account for 6 months or some period of time, they all get deleted. And so you have to make sure that you quickly recoup electronic discovery from all these different places.
You know, when I'm looking at this area, what I thought I would do now is we'll talk about the different types of sanctionable conduct. But before we go into that, let's talk about the standard of care required, which of course is split across different jurisdictions. And since Judge Francis, you're in one area, and Judge Sankovitz, you're in a different jurisdiction, if you wanted to talk about standard of care in your jurisdictions required before the sanctions might be appropriate.
Well, for federal courts, it's split among the different circuits. In our circuit, mere negligence is sufficient for even severe sanctions like an adverse inference. And the residential funding case in the Second Circuit is the touchstone there. In other circuits, there has to be some showing of intent before you get severe sanctions. And in general, I think it's fair to say that the actual sanction imposed is going to be calibrated according to the mens rea or the state of mind of the party that has destroyed evidence or otherwise failed to meet its discovery obligations. So obviously, the more evidence there is of bad faith, the more likely a severe sanction is going to be imposed. And whether there's going to be some movement in amendments to the federal rules or otherwise to standardize the state of mind requirement, I think, is something that we will look at down the line.
Mr. Sankovitz, in a lot of state courts, including Wisconsin, we draw the line at what we define as egregiousness. And so we're not so much looking at the difference between intent and negligence as we are between conduct that was foreseeably damaging, conduct that you might even call willful or at least reckless, based on how clear it was that the conduct or the failure to act would result in some actual prejudice or a flagrant violation of the rules. So we would not impose a sanction that would go beyond mere cost shifting unless we saw some evidence of that. That's important in understanding where we stand in this, you know, new era and how far along we are in the evolution of the profession's ability to deal capably with these electronic discovery issues, because the lawyers who are going to screw up in the early cases in our jurisdiction are not going to receive severe sanctions because they're not going to, at least absent proof to the contrary, the assumption is going to be that they didn't understand how bad their mistake was. But as time goes on and as more reports are published, like Dan's and the King and Spalding report, and I guess Gibson Dunn has done a report like this as well, the more those reports become commonly understood, the harder it's going to be for a lawyer to say, I didn't know I was making this kind of mistake, or my client didn't know. And then you're going to be dropping over onto the other side of the line into conduct that might fit that description of egregiousness.
That's an interesting perspective. Does that mean that in your jurisdiction, there would be no remedy for an innocent spoliation that perhaps has some significant impact on a party's ability to prove its case?
We have a whole separate jurisdiction for spoliation in particular, and so you might get an adverse inference instruction even with what you might call a negligent spoliation. But in terms of a dismissal or a refusal to put witnesses on or some monetary sanction that would exceed merely the cost of the other party trying to undo the damage, the cost of another deposition or something like that, those kinds of sanctions would be off limits until it became egregious.
Now, I wanted to go into some of the specific types of behavior, but before that I've, from the survey brought about sanctions. But before we do that, I just, from going to presentations at Georgetown and listen to people talk about the cases, just sort of an observation and a question. Is your sense that these cases are more the, oh my God, that's incredible, but it's on bad behavior, but it's on the periphery. It's not that typical, even though the numbers are growing. Is that your sense from looking at these cases, Dan, that these are the exception as opposed to really the rule in e-discovery?
My perception in looking at them was couched by the fact that these types of situations occurred in so many different types of courts and in so many types of cases that I didn't feel like they could truly be, considered to be marginalized. I think there's a difficulty with ESI. I think there's an importance with ESI, which requires proper management so that the evidence and the truth is found, such that I don't think that it's only the most egregious conduct that's going to be more and more in a sanctioned situation. I think you're gonna find more and more a situation where it's not willful, intentional spoliation, but there may be situations of good faith or innocent loss of data. And the real challenge is how to deal with that situation and still have the search for truth be pure without sanctioning more and more and more people.
I think we're
going to see this more. What I'm seeing now is, looking at cases more recently, is while the number of sanction awards has gone up as an absolute number, we're seeing less awards as a percentage of motions. You're seeing a lower number of successful sanction motions. And I think that courts are trying to look at this, trying to cull out any strategic use of sanction motions, and also trying to look to see whether there's truly prejudice to the party who is seeking discovery.
I think that's a really good point, and I wonder whether some of the problem of perception may be due to vocabulary and the fact that we call all of these things sanctions when a lot of them really are simply remedies. They're designed to restore the parties to the something like the status quo ante before information was lost, so that the parties are not prejudiced. And viewed in that way, I think, you know, they may be less, it may be less frightening to talk about what kinds of remedies there are than to talk about sanctioning parties and sanctioning attorneys.
From my perspective here in Wisconsin, the way a lot of these play out, the party that has made the error sometimes comes forward with the remedy.
Good.
You know, here's what we're offering to do to make up for this. And in that case, even though it goes down in the books as a sanction, I think all the parties and the judge walk away from it saying, good, we got that fixed. Now we can move on and try to solve the lawsuit.
Well, I will tell you from reading all these cases, that would be something that would be well received by the bench. I can see mitigation efforts, people coming forward and disclosing early so that it doesn't disrupt the preparation of the case, that there has been this problem with the ESI. What I see over and over again is that the sanctions become more egregious as there is, as someone mentioned, not prompt disclosure, even dissembling or making flat misrepresentations to the court. When that stuff happens, that's when judges seem to reach into the quiver for the more serious sanctions of either a terminating sanction or an adverse jury instruction.
Hey, this is Rick Sankovitz again. I don't, like I said, I haven't been able to follow these directly because the wave hasn't hit here yet, but I've followed it indirectly, and one of the ones I found most interesting was the experience of my friends at Jenner with that Morgan Stanley case.
Yeah.
And that, I think, follows what Dan just described about how, you know, at the outset, if people had come forward and came clean at the outset, that could have been resolved without a lot of headlines. But it just seemed to get worse. They just seemed to dig their grave deeper as the case went on.
Well, had to be a deep grave with all those backup tapes. So
yep.
Now let's talk about some of the specific types of behaviors and different types of cases that have occurred. And you know, for this part of the podcast, I'm going to start with Dan to give maybe a feel from his survey, an example or a fact, and then ask the group to talk about it. And I might call on one of you to start the discussion, but certainly if you have, like you've been doing, chime in. So the first area is cases where there was a failure to oversee the client's preservation efforts. Any thoughts on that, Dan, from your survey?
Yes. What we found in our survey is that the failure to preserve was the most common reason for a sanction. We found 90 cases where failure to preserve was identified as the sole reason for sanctioning, and in mixed cases, we found 46 other cases like that. The failure to preserve really starts in even a step before that under the Zubelake paradigm with that, failure to properly identify the sources and key players and then take steps to do that. The things that we're seeing in the cases, the types of conduct that start giving rise, start getting that sanction snowball rolling, are the failure to issue a litigation hold, whether it be orally telling the key players or doing it in writing, preserving only paper and failure to take into account ESI, failure to suspend automatic deletions, being aware of the potential relevance of backup tapes, but not doing anything about it. Poor search logistics where people that don't know the e-discovery infrastructure, don't know the email system, don't know the relevant data sources are put in charge. Failure to do a good search where you may look at individual files, but you don't look at the centralized files. You may look at that desktop, but you don't look at laptops, smartphones, BlackBerries. You get the employees' documents, but you don't get the board's documents. You do searches by just a file title rather than getting into the documents. You allow the client to get the documents based on what they understand, and they may not know to get drafts or they may not know to get emails. And then the last part of this kind of failure to preserve is just failure to follow up. And failure to keep your initial plan in place and viable.
Well, that's a pretty comprehensive overview. And Jim, I know you talked a little bit about the challenges on your end with individuals. Does proportionality play into this at all at preservation, or do you really have to preserve broadly regardless of how small the case? I mean, is that a challenge? We always talk about proportionality as being a way to maybe make this a little bit more manageable.
Well, I have to tell you, I think proportionality is probably the most underutilized argument from the defense bar. Again, I'm speaking from the typically asymmetrical.
This is an unusual lead-in. Go ahead, Jim.
Yeah, but it's true. You know, I think the argument that is likely to be well received, regardless of whether it's accepted, is proportionality, because there's certainly it certainly doesn't make sense to spend $1 million on discovery for a case that's worth $50,000. And while that may seem like an extra, proportionality, there are cases that aren't so far from that. And so it's frustrating for me, because many times my client will swear to me, and I will believe him or her, that there is dispositive evidence out there that she saw an email or was told about an email or other electronic evidence that will prove her case completely, the so-called smoking gun. But I'm not going to be able to turn a company's computer systems upside down to get that document if it doesn't show up in a more typical type of email search. And I'm probably only going to get so many bites at the apple for email searches, and that's probably worthy for a whole other podcast. So, proportionality is one of the toughest things that e-discovery brings to litigation that wasn't there to nearly the same degree prior to email and electronic discovery. When you were dealing with paper, you could talk about what was needed. The defendant was supposed to essentially do the search because they knew where the paper was, and it was either there or it wasn't. With e-discovery, if you think about it in a way, the defendant is relieved from the obligation to produce all relevant evidence, because it would be so vast that you wind up negotiating how to look for the relevant evidence, and I have to live with whatever's found. It isn't likely to be everything. So, it really all becomes, in the smart litigations, the discussion is all about proportionality.
The difficulty with proportionality in the context of sanctions is that if that's a defense after the fact, after documents and data have been spoliated, then you're at the mercy of a judge who may not take the same view that you do as to what was proportional to preserve. If the proportionality argument can be made at the time a preservation order is issued, or at the time the parties are discussing a stipulation as to preservation, that's one thing. But to assume that a judge will agree with you after the fact as to what was proportional is a little risky. I'm sure Judge Sankovitz will agree with me that all judges are reasonable. The problem is that they may be reasonable in different ways. They may have different views of what it is for discovery to be proportional, preservation to be proportional.
Reasonable is a pretty big ballpark.
Yep.
We did here in Wisconsin, when we adopted our version of the federal rules for our own procedure rules, was we tried to connect two concepts right at the outset of the case, and they're the two we've just been discussing. So at the scheduling conference, judges are required to discuss with the parties preservation in terms of the costs and benefits to the ongoing litigation. The Supreme Court, in its note that it attaches to the rule that's available for everybody to see when they're looking at the rule and preparing for the scheduling conference, emphasizes the importance of trying to manage the cost of electronic discovery. And although that word proportionality wasn't used in that note, I think it's pretty clear signal from the court to parties, raise it with the judge at the outset so everybody's clear about why you're looking, where you're looking, what you're preserving and what you're not, so that if later on something isn't found, and if something that wasn't found because we just decided not to look for that particular needle in that particular haystack, everybody would understand, well, that's what we agreed on at the outset.
Seems like these answers, Jim's answer in particular, led us right into the principles of cooperation, which seem to make a lot of these things a lot easier between the parties before you even get to the judges. So interesting. Now let's talk about another category, search and production failures, followed importantly by misrepresentations of the court over an extended period of time. Dan, what were you seeing there in your survey?
I think there were a couple of really interesting things in looking at cases that related to search. And one, from a counsel standpoint, that jumped out at me was the degree to which a counsel can rely upon a client's representations about the existence or volume or frequency of documents. When that counsel comes in and tries to identify key players, key sources of documents, and the client tells them that there aren't any documents or this is all the documents, is the counsel off the hook there? And what the cases tell you repeatedly, including Zublake, is that the counsel has an independent duty to investigate and to test whether or not representations by the clients that don't seem to be completely valid are in fact valid about the existence of documents. And there are some cases, like the Phoenix 4 case and other cases, where counsel has been sanctioned, where counsel has not gone in and strictly discharged their duty to fully investigate and search and identify discoverable ESI.
Yeah, I'd actually like to ask First Judge Sankovitz, since you've given some answers I'd characterize as being nice about some room to navigate the rules in the beginning or the working with ESI. Does misrepresentations to the court, how does that make you feel? Is that the shortest way to hang yourself?
Oh, yeah, particularly in jurisdiction here. I mean, there's a great old Irish expression, you know, it's a long road that has no turns. And when I was practicing in Chicago in a big firm and we ran across a bunch of lawyers in another big firm, that might be the last time we ever have to deal with them or that judge that we're the case is pending in front of. And so the hit we take to our reputation by screwing up is only as long as the lifespan of that case. But when you're working in a jurisdiction like Milwaukee or Kansas City or Fresno or Seattle and you make a mistake like this, the judges a mindset when it comes to sanctioning is I got to be worried not only about this case, but is there going to be misrepresentation like this in other kinds of cases and other kinds of species of misrepresentation, and that's where the sanctions really start to mount. So actual proof of misrepresentation is deadly, but I think the more that we understand our duties to help our clients preserve data and the more we understand our independent duty to the court to preserve that data, the more likely the judge is to reach the conclusion, you really should have known about this, and your failure to act really is something that deserves a sanction over and above simply whatever remedy we can try to create to undo the damage.
Dan, this next category amazes me. Failure to comply with court order discovery followed by lawyer misrepresentation. Is that just someone who realizes they're in trouble already and they just get into more trouble?
It really is, and I'm not sure that that's anything more it's really an ESI issue. I mean, you typically have the situation, document request, ineffective objections, incomplete document production, motion practice by the requesting party, getting in front of the judge, and the judge then issuing that appeal, and then for whatever reason, the producing party either doesn't produce the document on time or doesn't produce all the documents. And the cases that I look at, in a lot of instances, I think it's just people not responding to orders. It's not just responding to discovery orders. But from the discovery sense, it seems like the parties, the counsel that continue to get in trouble, continue after motion practice, after an order, to keep their narrow view of what's discoverable even after the judge rules. After the judge rules, my advice would be to broadly and fully comply on a timely basis with the judge's order. When you after an order don't comply with the judge's wishes, that's where these judges are coming down and hammering you, as they would in any context, ESI or not.
No, not there's a. This is an area I do want to get a little bit of discussion in. You know, I've been up in Ohio a number of times, and there were a number of lawyers that said we'd love to talk about standard of care, gross negligence, and whatnot, how we'd actually handle it here in this part of the country, which is a little different. One type of fact pattern which has created a fair amount of debate is the failure to advise clients on their obligation to preserve evidence. So, Dan, why don't we talk a little bit about pension committee, and maybe we can provide some advice to listeners on what they should do to advise their clients to preserve evidence.
Yeah, the pension committee case is a very helpful case in that it tries to identify those standards of conduct that will warrant the more serious type of sanctions. In that case, as I indicated earlier, you had the defendants there, the owners and administrators of an investment who were defendants seeking sanctions against plaintiff investor groups. And there were 13 different groups who, after their document production, the defendants looked at the documents and found that there were gaps in that production. They then went to the court. And a good strategic move, they asked the court to require the other side to put forth declarations that they had produced all the documents. Those declarations were later found to be wanting, and then the judge allowed there to be discovery of the discovery practices of those plaintiffs in producing documents to the defendants, and what they found. What Judge Shinlin found was of the 13 plaintiffs groups before the court, all 13 of them did not meet their e-discovery standards. She found that about half of those were grossly negligent. She found that they were grossly negligent for failing to issue a written legal hold, for failure to identify all key players to ensure that all paper records, for failure to turn off the automatic deletion, and for failure to preserve backup tapes where they were the sole source of the documents. And for those plaintiffs that were found grossly negligent, she sanctioned them with adverse jury instructions. For the other groups that she found merely negligent, she sanctioned them with lesser awards. And in a lot of instances, there was some of the same kind of sloppy, ill-designed collection efforts that did not rise to the level of the plaintiffs. They didn't find all of the documents. They didn't produce them on time. They didn't look everywhere they should. But there wasn't just the egregious or the more flagrant discovery lapses as there were with the plaintiffs who were found grossly negligent.
Judge Francis, don't you see this is or feel that this is like one of the more challenging areas of getting litigation holds in place, where people have different approaches, parties have different approaches, companies are different sizes. Isn't this almost like Judge Facciola's opinion about search going where angels fear, don't fear, you know?
It's unquestionably one of the most difficult areas, and I think what Dan has pointed out illustrates that one of the problems that counsel have is that they need to understand the client's information system. They can't simply issue a boilerplate litigation hold and expect that to be sufficient. They need to understand who the custodians are, what the computer architecture is in ways that they never had to understand before in a paper world. So it's the groundwork that they have to do before they even start issuing litigation hold that's important and is going to catch people up if they don't do it.
This is Rick Zankovitz. I think what makes it more difficult is the art of the practice these days. In the old days, when a party might have one set of lawyers that it retained for all of its litigation, And there'd be a regular opportunity to get to know how the company worked, and they'd be advising on a variety of different things. And the lawyers would have a certain kind of strategy for dealing with lawsuits as they came across the threshold. But now you have special counsel hired for bringing lawsuits on the plaintiff side, for defending lawsuits on the defense side. You might even have the situation where a client is used to having one set of directions when there's a lawsuit brought in, but the next set of lawyers follow a different set of directions, either much more detailed and explicit and careful, or maybe much more lax. And I think that that's a potential area for disaster too, because the what's a client to do when one lawyer says preserve and another lawyer says not?
Well, I think we covered some of the smaller areas with failure to produce earlier on, so I'm going to move into the end of this podcast or close to it. There has been a movement recently through the Duke Conference and now through the rules committees to amend the federal rules again to help clarify some of the requirements, specifically of preservation. Dan, do you think this is going to help or is it necessary?
I'm hopeful that it will help. I think that if you look at the cases empirically, the highest concentration of sanction awards focuses on the failure to preserve. If you ask practitioners, the toughest area to figure out is when is your duty to preserve triggered and what is the scope of that duty and what's the duration of that duty? Is it if someone sends you a demand letter but doesn't bring litigation for 18 months, are you still keeping that data on hold? So I think that there are some potential areas with trigger or scope, duration, whether you have a written litigation hold or the consequences for particular types of conduct there could be some clarification which would help the bar. The problem I see is that it's so fact-specific that it would be very difficult to write a specific rule that would fit all situations. My understanding is that the rule committee is not only looking at it from a perspective of looking at a preservation rule, but they're also looking to see whether or not part of the problem can be remedied by looking at the safe harbor and maybe broadening the safe harbor or as one of the judges indicated earlier, making uniform the level of culpability for certain conduct and having a safe harbor of sorts where if you didn't have that level of culpability, your range of sanctions for that particular misconduct is limited.
Yeah, boy, I sat through a meeting with 30 lawyers talking about this particular issue for an hour, and at the end of it thought we were no closer, although everyone agreed that we probably need some change.
Well, and it varies so much. I mean, in the employment area, a certain communication might trigger the duty to preserve, but in another situation it doesn't, and it's a very, very fact-intensive, specific analysis that's difficult.
Now, the rules are hard, and it's hard to come up an agreement on amendment. But one area that people talk about a lot is the area of cooperation. And Judge Francis, I know you've been involved in advocating that area. Since we've hit this high watermark with sanctions now, do you have any sense with a strong push to get more cooperation principles, which really have just been around for the last couple of years in full force, that we can reduce the level of sanctions?
Well, obviously, the more cooperation there is, the less likely that folks are going to be sanctioned. They're not, they're going to come to agreements, and it's going to foreclose the possibility that they're going to engage in conduct that's ultimately going to be sanctionable. The difficulty I have is what can we do as judges other than jawbone? What is it that's going to encourage parties to cooperate? I'm not sure what that is. I'm not sure how we can incentivize the parties to cooperate. I don't think that the answer is simply having sanctions out there as the ultimate hammer. I would hope that there's something that we can do beyond that and in addition to education. One thing that I know that they're looking at in Great Britain is having an initial conference that includes a discovery budget process. And once the parties have a discovery budget for electronic discovery, they're in a position where they really have to cooperate in order to meet that budget. I'm not sure I see that happening here anytime soon, but it's certainly one thing to keep in mind.
I'm going to have Chris Dale on a podcast real soon again, and I'm going to ask him about that one. It's an interesting trend. Now to wrap up here, looking into 2012, given the thought that we've put into this today, what are your predictions in the area of sanctions? Certainly you're not going to be held to it. I'm just curious your reaction. And we'll start with you, Judge Sankovitz, and sort of go around the table, Judge Francis, Dan, then Jim.
There's no real science that has accomplished itself in predicting the future, but if anyone comes close, it's economics. I think there's two economic trends that are going to make a big difference to sanctions in the future. One of them is the economics of actually performing electronic discovery. The cost of doing the work is reducing rather than increasing. The more it reduces, the more people that are going to be involved in electronic discovery, more clients, more lawyers, but also more novices. And so there's going to be more people who screw up, and of course some of them will screw up badly. So in the near term, I see more sanctions with more people involved in electronic discovery, and that'll tail off after a while. But the other thing I see is this, because the technology improves and the ability to recover data improves, I think we'll also have an improved ability to remedy these problems rather than sanction our way around them. And so I see, Dan in the future writing a report which says large numbers of sanctions, but a lower amount of sanction per incident.
Interesting. Okay. Judge Francis?
I think I agree with Judge Sankovitz's general perspective. I think that we're going to continue to see sanctions trending upward, but that they will level off, partly for the reasons that he's indicated, and partly because I think there will be some pushback from the judges at some point in terms of counsel making more and more sanctions motions, as there was, for example, with Rule 11. I think in the beginning you saw lots and lots of motions, and it was trending upward quite quickly. Judges began to express some anger or some concern with the number of motions, and then the motions trailed off. And so in addition to the economic factors that have been identified, I think there's also an individual judicial temperament factor that will probably put the cap on these at some point, but certainly not within the next year.
Jim, your reaction to this area?
I too think there's going to be more sanctions applications, and I think that's going to be a function of the fact that people are becoming more and more knowledgeable about what should be done. I mean, in my experience, my observation, the plaintiff's bar is actually far behind the curve from the defense bar, again, in these asymmetrical litigations. And as they become more and more knowledgeable about what should be preserved and what is available in production, they're more likely to make more motions. And to touch on a point that was made earlier in the podcast, defense firms are realizing that, hey, this is a double-edged sword, and the plaintiffs have a duty to preserve, and they're starting to ask the kinds of questions that we've been asking for a while of defense firms and defendants. We're getting those questions as individuals, and when individuals aren't preserving things, nothing a company likes more than to realize, hey, what was good for them is also good for us, and it evens out the playing field. So I think there's going to be a lot more sanctions made in the near term as people become more and more educated about e-discovery and its relationship to the litigation as a whole. And then it will level off because, like all bodies of law, once we get enough decisions and enough guidance from the courts and everybody develops a sense of what's appropriate, there's less deviance from that,
and Dan,
deviation from that.
Dan, since there's a likelihood you'll do a survey again next year, you may get asked this as your first question to compare what you predicted versus what actually happened. So what do you think is going to happen next year?
Well, I did pick the Packers last night.
So there you go.
That's some confidence in you, man.
I think all of these are prudent observations. I think in the short term, I'm pessimistic that there will be an increase of sanction motions, whether that's because of the continued difficulty of ESI, whether it's a strategic effort by a litigant to early in the case get in front of the judge and paint the other side as inept or worse. And I believe, as one judge mentioned, that there continues to be litigants out there who have not mastered ESI, and because of that, they will be the target of sanction motions. I'm optimistic that the number of sanctions awarded as a ratio of all sanction motions will go down as judges dig deeper and truly look at prejudice and alternative sources of information and try not to drop the hammer as quickly or as heavily as they could under the circumstances.
Well, I'd like to thank you all. You all have different perspectives, and I think this turned into a real nice show. So thanks for joining us. So thank you, Judges Francis and Sankovitz, Dan and Jim, for joining us here at ESI Bites. It's always a pleasure to have experts such as you to share your knowledge with us and our listeners, and hopefully we'll be able to do more shows with you later this year. To the listeners, if you've enjoyed this podcast, I'd encourage you to go to www.esibites.com with a Y for a complete list of our show. You can also remember our show and website phonetically, as it sounds out as Easy Bites of ESI information. So however you choose to remember us, come to ESI Bites to learn more about eDiscovery before ESI bites you back. This is Carl Shinneman, Director of Legal Analytics and Review from Juranov, wishing you a nice day.